So here we are this evening, beginning the fourth of the five-part presentation on Earth Sila. Sila, as we know, is the collective term for three aspects of the Buddha's Eightfold Path in terms of achieving the cessation of suffering. Okay. The three meditative aspects are concentration, mindfulness, and effort. Okay. And as those meditative qualities are established, they lay the foundation, they make possible the arising of the two wisdom factors. Okay. And in those, the obtaining wisdom into the causes and conditions that gave rise to who you are in the moment, also then makes possible the arising of the wisdom factor of wise or beneficial intention, which is the ability to have insight into who you may become in the immediate future based upon the intentions underlying your speech, your actions, and your way of life. And those are the last three aspects of the Eightfold Path. How we speak, how we act, the actions that we take, and the traditional translation of the last one is right livelihood, or right wise livelihood, but it actually extends far beyond just vocation or what one does for a living. It's actually more how one makes one's way in the world. So in the Earth Sila series, what we've been doing is applying the Buddha's teachings on these three aspects of the Eightfold Path, the fruition, the way they manifest in the world, applying them specifically to the question of how to embody, how to manifest these teachings in our environmental relations, how we relate to other sentient beings, and how we relate to the environment itself. So the first of the, those three aspects, right or wise or beneficial speech, as we began the series, spoke about that in terms of environmental discourse. Okay. The literature that we come across, the things we hear, whether broadcast or the print media, any of the public discourse that we find in our environment about the environment. No. Paying careful attention as we listen to what's being said and what the sources of information are. Okay. And what we're contemplating saying ourselves. Right. Keeping that within the context of the Buddha's teachings on wise speech. He said, as you are about to engage the mouth, first go through this checklist. Is the speech you're intending to utter beneficially intended? Okay. It's intended to be helpful. Okay. Is it useful? Does it serve a good purpose? Is it truthful? Is it timely? And is it kind? So those are all criteria that we can use for evaluating whatever environmental discourse comes our way, whether it's just what gets generated in the news media, or whether it's information that we actively seek out, like the program Mahedi was just talking about, on KGNU. Going places for information, for background, for perspectives on environmental problems that don't just necessarily bubble up to the top in the mass media. Where are some places we can go for useful information? So this entire realm of environmental discourse is one way to think about applying the Buddha's teachings and right speech, okay, to environmental affairs. Right or wise or beneficial action. For the purposes of this series, what I did was to incorporate into that, okay, the Buddha's precepts for laypersons, which is how to live in the world in ways that don't generate bad karma and don't cause suffering, okay, but instead generate beneficial karma and alleviate suffering. Okay. And he had five precepts for laypersons. First one is not killing, okay, or respecting, honoring life. And in speaking about that, traditionally, when they said, and his advice was to not kill living beings, he was talking, they were referring mostly to animals. But the criteria they used for defining living being was, does it have some form of consciousness? Is it capable of responding to positive and negative stimuli and reacting appropriately? And the other is, does it respire? Does it breathe? And we now know that both of those conditions apply to plant life as well. So, avoiding killing is a tough one because, except for the plants, that do photosynthesis, in our ecosystem, in our world, life feeds on life. Something died that we may live, right? And so, applying that precept, that teaching, of respecting life, seeking to minimize the amount of killing that has to go on as we live. There are a lot of ways to think about that. Certainly, as we pay attention to what we eat, all right, to what we consume. And then, are there other realms in which there's a lot of killing that goes on in order for human beings to be on this earth? Destruction of habitat, for instance. Destruction of animal and plant species for achieving other ends, like the extraction of energy fields. So the programmer is, if you want to think of them that way, environmental discourse is one, paying attention to non-harming ahimsa, or minimizing the amount of killing that has to go on for us to live, is another one. Second of the Buddha's precepts, five precepts, is not taking that which is not given. And basically, these precepts, for the most part, about how to live together in society, how to live together with others, being in as much as we are social beings. But it also can be more broadly understood to refer to our ability to distinguish between wants and needs, which is to say, what do we, other human beings, other sentient beings, really need in order to be able to live safely and healthily on the earth? Okay. As distinguished from what, for every reason, we decide we've just got to have. Not necessarily because it's a need, but because it's a desire that we have to fulfill some other purpose. Okay. After that, the next precept the Buddha talked about for lay people was not to engage in sexual misconduct. And as I read a little more deeply in the commentaries, others' writings about what he's trying to get at there, and the various fairly explicit instructions that came along with it, almost all of them had to do in one way or another with sexual exploitation. They had to do with violating the relationship if there's a person that is in a position of trust, okay, of not committing infidelity, of not exploiting other human beings for the purposes of sexual gratification. A little more broadly conceived, what he at root was trying to get at was, beware of the power, the destructive and harmful power of blind lust. Okay. Of lust that causes you to be numb to or blind to the negative effects of seizing what you want, irregardless of the consequences, irregardless of the harm that it might cause to others. Okay. So, most explicitly, of course, to honoring one's sexuality and that of others, not taking advantage, not coercing. Okay. But then more broadly, being mindful of the power of your desires to blind you to their consequences. Okay. And then the precept of not lying, which bundled into the right speech category already. And then the fifth of the Buddha's precepts for lay persons had to do with clear-mindedness. And what he said in that regard was there's certain substances that if you ingest them, and he spoke specifically about fermented and distilled beverages. He said there are certain substances that if you ingest them have the effect of impeding your ability to be mindful, to have a concentrated mind. He has this whole other teaching on obstacles to concentration, okay, where he said these are powerful aspects of mind that make it difficult or impossible for the mind to be concentrated and clear. Okay. Anger is one. Anger, aversion, ill will. Lust is the second one. Okay. Sloth and torpor, as is classically said, you know, a sense of dullness or being out of it or nodding off or whatever, you know, is the third. Okay. The fourth is anxiety and restlessness. The fifth is doubt. The first three, ingesting intoxicants, amplifies massively. Okay. Can cause people to become very lustful and mindless. Okay. Cause people to become extremely angry, okay, or extremely fearful sometimes, or extremely dull, right? Just nod off, out of it. So he said, it's not such a great idea to ingest these things because they have that effect, okay? And when your mind is affected in that way, it makes it much more likely that you're going to say and do very unwholesome things. Going to create bad karma for yourself and others. So he said, these were not commandments. Again, you know, we say this over and over again. It's more like a natural history lesson where he's saying, you know, if you behave in this way, these are the very likely consequences of doing so. But if you behave in this more skillful or mindful or compassionate way, okay, these are the likely outcomes. So better to honor life and be compassionate than to be cruel. Right? Better to seek to be as generous as you can rather than seizing everything you can. Okay. So generosity is an antidote for greed. Doing what you can to stay awake. Okay. And then this interesting little cluster, you know, of lust or, you know, desire and delusion, okay, and distortion of mind, right? That if there's something you decide that you really want, right, so that the grasping power is strong, that you know, the lust tends to generate a deluded state of mind. You tend not to see the downsides, the shadow sides of satisfying that particular desire. And in the mind, in the event that the mind is starting to wake up to that, well, then you always have these handy means of, you know, really reinforcing the delusion by getting loaded, right? Okay. Which will make it much more likely that something unwholesome is going to happen. So, in putting these together, you know, the not taking that which is not given, you know, being very mindful about what we consume and how much of what we consume in order to meet what purposes. Being mindful of the ways that we seek to not acknowledge, to lie to ourselves about the impacts of runaway desire. Okay. then sometimes actively doing things to prohibit ourselves from being able to see that, you know, in terms of use of intoxicants. All of this I bundle in this area of what I'm calling consumption and clear-mindedness, you know. Waking up to how much of what we consume and why, what are some of the ways that we seek to delude or mask ourselves from our patterns of consumption, the effects of our consumption. Okay. And then how can we foster this waking up process? So when I think about patterns of consumption, certainly it has to do with things like food and drink, but also every other material means by which we make our way in the world. The last of the sessions, the last of the series in 2 weeks, I'm calling energy flow and way of life. And in that one, we're going to have a closer look at the flow of wealth as a circulatory system. Okay, where does wealth come to us from? By what means do we generate it? How do we expend it? And with what effects? So we're looking at the flow of wealth as an energy flow system, and then absolutely the flow of energy itself. You know, what are the sources from which we get electrical and motive energy? How do we use it, and with what effects? So those are sort of the four major program areas that I'm interested in us developing, perhaps on an ongoing basis here in the Sangha. And as we get closer to the end of our time this evening, I want to share with you a little more of my thinking about how we might develop an ongoing program of Earth Sila study activity and action, perhaps, here in the Sangha, in partnership with the other Sanghas of the Front Range and nationally as well. But before getting there, I want to spend a little bit of time doing a little bit of framing of some of the thoughts and the images and the myths that have informed my own thinking in this realm of consumption, mindful versus mindless consumption. So about 20 years or so ago, some of you who knew me then know that I wrote a book called Worship in Wilderness. And the book is about culture, religion, and law and the management of public lands and resources. And what I did in the research for that book was I started out with some legal conflicts that had kind of flared up here and there around the country between American Indian tribes and public land managers over how the sites that they held sacred on the public lands were being managed. And that really fostered in me a really deep and abiding, ongoing interest in spiritual relationship between indigenous peoples, both here in North America and elsewhere, and the land, you know, and the role that the land and resources played in informing their spiritual sensibilities and consciousness, and how they manifested that. One of the reasons that I was doing this research is because I wanted to find out if there were any teachings from these ancient peoples, been around for, in some cases, thousands of years, and are somehow still managed to hang on, despite our best, you know, the best efforts of Western civilization to do otherwise. Are there any lessons to be found in their cultures that might be of benefit to us at this point in time? One of the teachings that made the greatest impression on me, and one that I know that several of you have heard me talk about in here more than once, concerns the peoples now living, in indigenous peoples now living in the upper Rio Grande Valley and on the Hopi Mesas and on the Zuni Reservation. They are the descendants of a very ancient people that lived in the American Southwest in the Four Corners region quite a long time ago. Their creation myths all talk about them having emerged from the earth, and all these cultures, certainly the ones in the upper Rio Grande, have this familiar architectural edifice called the kiva, that is a subterranean room around room that And you find them in the ruins throughout the Four Corners area, Upper Rio Grande. And you find them, you know, alive and well and very well maintained in all the pueblos of the Upper Rio Grande, most of them anyway. And so they're used for various purposes, but among them, the ceremonial purpose of a kiva is its understanding as a kind of a reconstruction of the place from which they were born, you know, the place where they were emerged from the earth into the opening, and they have that structure there to remind them of that origin story. So, in their own understanding, they've been here since time immemorial. The archaeologists say that those people came up from Mexico and elsewhere and began to inhabit the Upper Colorado Plateau probably around 600 to 800 AD, that over time they became considerably more sophisticated in terms of agriculture, in terms of architecture, in terms of hydrologic engineering, until by around the 1100s or so, 1200s, we began to see these very sophisticated, multi-storied, large architectural structures throughout the Four Corners area, especially, you know, around Mesa Verde and the places where the most striking, magnificent, and elaborate ones are. Also Chaco Canyon and these other sites in the Four Corners area and the greater American Southwest. Populations evidently really grew and grew. There were some of these sites that had 8,000 to 10,000 people living in them. As their technology got better, they were able to support larger and larger populations and build bigger and bigger structures. And then along in the 1200s or so, and into the 1300s, something very dramatic occurred. Okay. And his book, Collapse, Jared Diamond writes about various civilizations over, you know, from ancient times to the present that experienced severe environmental crises and challenges, some of which managed to survive them, that their cultures were resilient enough that they could rapidly change how they lived, and others that were not able to do so, or that had gone so far beyond what the environment was able to support that they simply collapsed. Over about an 80-year period, these big, giant, elaborate, highly populated structures in the Four Corners area were all abandoned. It was during a period of severe and sustained drought. It's about a 60-65-year drought. And one of the more popular theories about why this abandonment happened is that these civilizations had gotten to the very edge of the carrying capacity of their environment. In terms of gathering fuel, in terms of how they were living on the earth, in terms of the sophistication, the agriculture, that they were right on the edge of the environment, continuing to be able to support them as they were. And then suddenly, when there is a dramatic environmental change, you know, when the amount of water was reduced by more than half, their crops failed, the wildlife fled. They just didn't have enough water to keep living as they had been. And so when they abandoned the Four Corners area, they migrated to places that had more water. They migrated to the Upper Rio Grande that still had water in it, you know, or down to the Hopi Mesas. They went to the places where the water was. Okay. Because they had so outstripped or gotten so close to the edge of the environment in the situation, in the state that they were accustomed to it being, that when their environment radically changed, it could no longer support them, and they could not change their way of being fast enough to accommodate the radical change, and they had to simply leave the area. So the event, the ceremony that I had an opportunity to witness at the invitation of the war chief for the Taos Pueblo in 1999 in January was the Deer Dance. And the Deer Dance is one in which, and I have since learned that there are several other tribes that do the Deer Dance as well. The Deer Dance replicates how historically the Pueblo people hunt. Okay. And especially when they are going on a big hunt to bring in a lot of meat to preserve to get them through the winter time. Okay. So in the fall hunt, what they do is they go up into the mountains and they go to these canyons where there's good habitat and where they knew that the wildlife was pretty plentiful. And then the hunters, some of them would go up along the canyon rim, okay, and they would start working their way down the canyon walls, and they would have big branches with them, and they would beat their clubs, and they would beat the earth and make noise and frighten the wildlife. And the wildlife, in fleeing them, would flee downhill into the floor of the canyon and then try to go out the mouth of the canyon. Down in the floor of the canyon and the mouth of the canyon were the other hunters. And as all the wildlife began to stream out, the hunters would pick them off. So they could very quickly kill a bunch of deer, a bunch of bear, all kinds of rabbits, you know, just about everything that, you know, lived down there that had four legs and could run away was running down the canyon, and they killed it. You know, it's kind of like these big ocean trawlers in the ocean now. They go out there with these giant nets and just scoop up everything on the floor of the ocean. That's kind of what they were doing as well. That's how they hunted. Very efficient. Got a lot of meat in a hurry in years when it was good, when the hunting was good. So in the dance, it takes place in, they did it in this big, in this kind of the town square on Taos Pueblo in front of the church. And as it begins, the first dancers to come in are women who are dressed in brown buckskin. They're holding pine boughs and juniper boughs, and they have pine boughs painted on their dresses. And at one end of the opening in the open area, it's a giant drum, you know, 8-10 feet across, and all the elders are there beating the drum. The women dancers come in and they form a kind of a big oblong enclosure. It's about 20 or so yards wide and about 40 yards long, maybe something like that. Later on, I discovered, as I thought about it some more, it was roughly in the shape of a uterus. And then it had a narrow mouth, which is down by where the drum was. Okay. And then after they had come in there and they'd formed this enclosure and they were dancing to the drum, then out of the kiva came the male dancers. And the male dancers were led by these two really tall guys in white buckskin. And they, the first dancers were the deer dancers. And they had deer antler headdresses, okay, and they were holding sticks as like front legs, and so they were dancing as if they were the deer, and they were being led by the tall men in the white buckskin, and then all the other animals followed them. It was dancers who were also dressed in the skins of animals, right? And I came to learn later on from my host that in order to participate in the deer dance, you had to kill the animal whose skin you wore, and so these were kind of fresh pelts, you know, and with the heads of, you know, mountain lions and bears and a couple of bison, and all these, they were portraying all of these animals, okay, who would be led into this enclosure. And then once they get into the enclosure, they started to dance around. The last dancers to come in were the clowns who were portraying the hunters who were going to hunt the animals. And the clowns were in whiteface. and they had bows and arrows, and so they would follow the animals into the enclosure. The animals were milling around, and the hunters would pantomime killing them, and then they'd hoist the other animal dancer over their shoulder, and they'd make their way to the mouth of the canyon, right? And there stood these tall men in the white buckskin, and when they got down to the mouth of the enclosure, the tall men in buckskin would turn them around and force them to release the animals that would go back then in pantomime dancing. It's like bringing them back to life again and putting them back into the canyon, and then they would keep pantomiming, killing the animals and bringing them down to the mouth of the canyon, and then the tall guys in buckskin would make him turn them loose again. And this went on for quite some time, and they did it in different parts of the opening there in Taos Pueblo. And I had some intuition as to what I thought was going on, but I asked my host afterwards, who had been dancing the part of one of the hunters, and a friend of his who was dancing the part of a hawk. And so I asked him about that particular interaction there and what the different dancers were called. And he said the closest English translation for what those people were, he said, would probably be wardens, you know, like game wardens, kind of. And he said, what the dance signifies is that we discovered long ago how to hunt effectively and efficiently, and how to quickly lay in more than enough meat to get us through the wintertime, okay, beyond subsistence hunting. And he said, and there were several occasions when we pretty much wiped out everything in these different canyons, he said. But so the hunters have a tremendous amount of skill and knowledge. They know how to kill everything in sight. He said, what they lack is wisdom. They're fools, you know, and they pantomime behaving foolishly, he said, because they have no understanding of the effect of the application of their knowledge, their technical skill, to the environment. They're too foolish to understand they're wiping out the whole resource base on which the entire tribe depends. And so it's the job of the wardens at the mouth of the canyon to teach the hunters over and over and over again how foolish they are and how they have to stop doing what they're doing in order to keep the tribe itself from being wiped out. They do this dance about every 7 years, interspersed with some others. Okay. But one of the things that made such a huge impression upon me as he explained this dance quite more fully, and as I was able to put that in the context of the history of his tribe, okay, which about 700 or 800 years ago had to leave the Four Corners area because they outstripped the environment and their society collapsed. And then once they got to the upper Rio Grande, that lesson has evidently stayed with them for the last 800 years. And in the way that he explained it to me, it has played the reason they do it over and over again, the reason they keep re-educating every generation, you know, every few years as they come along, is to remember this relationship between knowledge and wisdom, that we have this enormous power, you know, that we can exert influence over the world wildly disproportionate to our innate capabilities as, you know, weak little mammals, right? But we have this extraordinary power that we've gained, you know, through technology that has enabled us to transform the world, right? Probably, well, a lot of people say, not necessarily for the better. And the Pueblos faced the same thing almost 1,000 years ago. They realized that their skill, that their knowledge had gotten them to places they never could have dreamed. And then it all collapsed. and they had to start over. But they started over with a kind of wisdom they didn't have before. And it's one of the things that's kept them going for the last 1,000 years. They've been able to let that lesson sink in and teach it to themselves repeatedly in such a way as it is core to their very being, core to their very culture. I tried really hard for some time after visiting the dance to think of whether there's any ceremony even, you know, approximating to any degree at all in our own culture, those kinds of lessons, and nothing really came to mind. It did occur to me, however, that maybe we could really use one. So, bringing this all forward, are there any particular examples that come to mind for anyone here as to ways in which perhaps our knowledge has outstripped our wisdom?
Water in Las Vegas.
Or water in the Southwest.
Las Vegas has boomed, and it's crazy. It's insane.
Water in Denver.
Sure. Okay.
Water mixed with toxic fracking fluids forced down to crack rock, and that you hope will never come back up again. Because if that water comes back, it's going to be poisoned.
Mountaintop mining. Mountaintop mining in Appalachia.
Sure. Okay. A very simple thing. Oranges in the middle of December.
They don't grow around here, do they?
They don't grow around here.
Where do they come from?
Chile.
Yeah. Other end of the world.
We have the knowledge. We know how to do it. We can get our grapes whenever we want. Fresh strawberries for our breakfast, or blueberries. But the cost.
So what is, if we had to design a, somebody get the door. Thanks. If we had to design a our own deer dance, what would it look like? How should we go about reminding ourselves about this relationship between knowledge and wisdom?
Slot machine headdress.
Stephen.
Building a house and burning it down.
What do you tell? Say the significance of that.
Everybody come together, build a shelter, a house, or whatever. Really think, and it's burning the whole thing down.
And why? What's the significance?
That's what we're doing.
Aha. Okay. That's what the Tibetan sand painters do, isn't it? Yeah. Spend weeks on a gorgeous mandala, and then give the old heave ho, right? Please.
It seems to me that just as effective in terms of its destructiveness is, I guess greed came up from my own development. I was just, for some reason, thinking about why I don't go up the Grand Lake anymore. And it's because I get so angry. There's that beautiful, beautiful lake. And it's almost entirely bound by private homes. And I was thinking of all the happiness that could be created by allowing people to walk and bike and hike around the lake, but you can't.
Yeah.
It's all owned by someone. There's a, by the way, in terms of, you know, information about useful media, PBS has done a series on the history of national parks.
Yes, I've been watching that.
It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I was just contrasting the thinking, the spirit of people like John Muir,
yeah,
who of course is grateful to what he learned from the native peoples, yeah, of this continent, with the crass, greedy development that, and I had no idea that they'd commercialized the Niagara Falls so much.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that really struck me about that series was, you know, during the last quarter of the 19th century and the advent of the Gilded Age and you know, wholesale, you know, legislatures for sale and whatnot, that there was this rapacious, wildly destructive behavior that took place, you know, around the industrialization of the country, with some people becoming, you know, fabulously wealthy and powerful, and others living in grinding poverty. And it was real easy in retrospect to just, you know, absolutely, utterly demonize these industrialists, you know, who earned their wealth in the way that they did. And then I came to learn that we have entire national parks that would not have existed if people like the Rockefellers hadn't gotten out their checkbook. Yeah. So, you know, in terms of flow of wealth and energy, you know, it was, you know, the governor of Colorado called out the, you know, formed up a National Guard out of some of the denizens of Denver saloons to go down to Ludlow and blow away a bunch of, you know, families of striking miners in order to, you know, protect Rockefeller's plants down there. But still in all, at some point in time, those people, you know, the Rockefellers and Carnegie and that crowd, you know, they realized this astonishing wealth that they had and some of what they'd done to get it. And there was obviously some kind of transformation, some kind of transmutation that went on that allowed them to see that it was time to give back. It was time to do what was possible to keep everything that they had benefited from being utterly consumed by commercialism. So there was that aspect of it, actually, that wound up giving me some hope, not only, you know, gratitude for what we have in terms of our parks, but maybe also for the future. Yeah, David.
I was just thinking as far as a contemporary deer dance ceremony in, you know, bio-intensive permaculture, one of the principles is that you plant enough for yourself and for the garden. In other words, you don't have to harvest everything for yourself.
Oh.
There's enough for not only the occasional squirrel and rabbit, but there's also enough to just go back into the soil, that the plants themselves are bringing sunlight to new, you know, to nurture and nutriment of the soil. So with that, you know, at the end of a harvest, you could do something, I don't know, call it Thanksgiving. Maybe, you know, skip the Detroit Lions and the some of the other less agreeable parts, but really gather the people and actually give thanks for
yes.
the experience of what a garden gives, and in part because, and in part express that by allowing the garden to actually feed the soil, it feeds the plants, it feeds the people.
Don't take it all, in other words. Yeah.
Yeah. Let your garden feed the garden.
Thank you very much. Well, this time I want to make sure that we do leave enough time to go out singing, as has been our wont. So.
But I'm not the only one.
Perhaps someday you'll join us, and the world can live as one. Imagine no possessions. Wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. You man.